I was up in Kentucky and speaking on a special program that I'd been on for years. And that night in the motel, I could tell something was happening to me. The only way I could sleep would be sitting in a chair. Well, then I had to drive about nearly 2.5 hours home. And then the next thing I knew, I was in the hospital for several days, and then in rehab for weeks. And so I missed being here. And the folks down at East Main in Murfreesboro, and some of you came to the program there, they were nice enough to change the day they'd have that men's meeting for my convenience. Because for several years, I would go to Alabama for Decoration Day and put fresh cut roses on the graves of my parents and some other relatives. Well, I was not able to do that, obviously. So they changed the date. I could go down, have a meeting with the committee, and just be enjoying the whole gathering for that cemetery decoration. It's a big thing in Alabama for country cemeteries to have those decorations. Well, then, when all of this other happened, then after they had gone to the trouble even of changing the day they had that men's meeting, then lo and behold, the day came for me to go to the cemetery decoration, put out the roses. And to tell you the honest truth about it, I didn't feel like going. I didn't have anybody to take me. One of my nephews called, said, "I'll come and get you." I didn't want him to do all that driving. So I just stayed in bed. I missed all of that. But next year, the Lord willing, I'm going to have better plans, I hope. And one of my better plans next year, if I promise this church I'm going to be here like the Friends and Family Day, and I'm not advertising for something to do either. If I make a commitment, I've already mentioned to Joe the Servants' Day that I hope and pray I could be a part of, because it's one of the great, great gatherings. Well, I needed to give you that explanation, and I'm ready now to begin sitting like Jesus sat and taught them. Jesus, in one of his great beatitudes, said, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." Jesus had a unique way of illustrating great observations like that about being merciful. And one that he immediately told a little later, he told about a man going from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And the man fell among thieves and robbers, and they robbed him, they beat him, and left him for dead by the side of the road. By and by, a priest came by, you know, the very essence of religion. And this priest looked at the fellow, but passed by on the other side. And then a Levite, I mean, he could sing in the synagogue. He came and he looked, and then he passed by on the other side. And then here came a Samaritan. And if you remember John 4, the lady told Jesus, "The Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans." If I had time, I'd give you the background of the origin of the Samaritans, but I don't have the time. But anyway, Jesus then said this Samaritan, he had compassion on the man. He got him up, took him into the town, put him in an inn, and told the innkeeper, "Now you take care of him, and when I come back, I will pay what is owed." And Jesus said, "Now who was the real Samaritan?" And the fellow said, "They that had mercy on that man." Now, I want to promise you folks something. By the roadside of life today, there are many people that have been beaten, some physically beaten. In fact, in Nashville, they have a safe home for ladies that have been beaten by their husbands to flee for their own security. There have been many young people who have been beaten by the side of the road by some professor who was trying to intimidate them before the entire group, embarrass them. They have been beaten. And what they need is somebody who's merciful. When I think about somebody really, really being beaten, and you've seen this on the news, the way that those guys treated that young woman, I'm talking about the football players, the way they treated her. Now, I have a category for folks like that. They are subhuman. They don't belong with the human race. But there are any number of people that have been beaten. But I want us to key on what Jesus said. He that showed mercy. You and I have opportunities that come our way to be nice to people, to encourage people. And then in all possibility, when you have as many people as we have here this morning, some of you may feel maybe not physical abuse, but you may feel a type of emotional abuse. One of the sad things that Jesus said, from my perspective, is John chapter 16 and verse 32. The hour is coming when the Son of Man shall be gathered unto those that are going to afflict him. And he said, all of you will leave me alone. Now that very word, alone, you know, we have songs about it. How many times have you sung, I don't know anything in the whole wide world that's worse than being alone? And even out in the secular world, they have songs about being alone. Only the lonely know the way I feel tonight. So I think about being merciful to people, being kind to people, being nice to people. I think probably we all have met someone that for whatever reason seemed to talk down to people. I read about a man who, in hiring people for his office, the last thing he would do after all the interviews and the exams, he would take them to a restaurant and he would observe how they talked to the waitress or the waiter. And if they tried to impress him by talking down to that person, they'd lost it. He had no time for them. When a person came that we have hired to kindly help me at home, keep the house clean, prepare food, one of the first things I told them, I said, now, you know, my self-esteem is not at the mercy of me trying to boss you around. I will not do that. I'm going to treat you the way I want to be treated, with respect. You know, I read in a book one time, you do unto others, it's a paraphrase, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's pretty good direction right there. So when I think about showing mercy, being kind, being understanding, being helpful, that is so very, very important. Now, I want to give you two biblical illustrations of being merciful, and then I want to give you what I'll call an in-life explanation. Jesus told about a man that wanted his servants to give account, and one of them owed him $10 to $12 million. Now, I'm pretty sure it was Roman coin the way they evaluated, because when Jesus said, bring me a coin, and he said, whose inscription is on it? And they said, Caesar's. Romans were in control, quite obviously. So this man owed a debt of $10 to $12 million. And so the verdict was given, okay, we're going to sell him, we're going to sell his family to pay on his debt. And the man begged for mercy. Be patient with me, said, and I'll pay you all. And it so moved this fella that he forgave the debt. $10 to $12 million. Well, then he went out and found a fella that owed him, in Roman coins, about a day's pay for a day's work. And he told this fella, said, now you pay me. And the man said, be patient with me. No, sir, I want my pay right now. Well, the word came back to this fellow that had forgiven that great debt, and he called this fellow on the carpet, if you please, and the man had to pay a price for that kind of lack of mercy. And then you can read where Jesus talked about people who would be kind and understanding and forgiving, and they were demonstrating mercy. I'm going to give you an in-life illustration. I have been blessed and honored several times to be invited to Houston, Texas, either to hold meetings or to speak at teachers' meetings and special occasions. And so I was being told a story one time about a man, a businessman, prominent businessman, on his way to one of the club meetings. And he happened to stop to get some breath mints. And he noticed, as he went into this little 7-Eleven store, a little boy sitting there crying. And he said, son, what's wrong? And he said, my daddy gave me $2 to come and get some milk. And he said, I've lost the money on the way here, and my daddy is home drunk, and when I go home, he's going to beat me. The fellow said, son, go with me. They went in the store, and he told, the fellow said, sack this boy up some milk. He said, now, son, you come over here, you pick out any candy you want, and as much candy as you want. So the little boy picked him out a sack of candy. And then he looked up at this fellow and said, I wish you were my daddy. The man said, I missed my club meeting that night. I drove around different parts of Houston looking for a 7-Eleven store where there was a little boy crying. Now that's my in-life illustration for you. So I think in terms of the possibility of all of us showing mercy. I don't know about you, but I need that. And one of the things that I have as a child of God, I have access to God's throne. And when the Hebrews writer over in chapter 3 says, we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feelings of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. And then a little later he would say, let us come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain what? Mercy. Come to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. One of the great blessings of the Christian life is having access to God's great throne of mercy. Now, when I think about when the end comes for all of us and for me, and there's no premonition or anything, for me it's not all that much longer, it's just a fact. You know, I've read Psalms 90 like you have. Our days are 80, if by reason of strength they're 80. And so if you've got physical strength and you have supportive strength from friends and family, then you can keep going in this life. But when I read the little book of Jude, right over next to Revelation, he says, keep yourselves in the love of God, looking for the mercy of the Lord to everlasting life. Now you couple with that, 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 9, he said that we look, gird up the loins of your mind, and look to the end for the grace that's to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So you got two things. You have grace and you have mercy. Now they're different. We know that grace is when God gives us what we never could earn, never could deserve, never could merit. It flows out of his great love for us, as we read in Ephesians 2. And then over in Jude, he says, you look for the mercy of the Lord for everlasting life. I have tried on different occasions to comfort people who were nearing the end of life's journey and just felt like, to use the expression, I haven't been good enough. Well, you know, none of us are good enough that we can demand entrance into heaven. It'll come through the grace and mercy of God. Now, God's grace is when he gives us that we don't deserve, and God's mercy is when he doesn't give us what we deserve. And so we look for what? We look for grace and mercy. And I've tried to tell people who were nearing the end of the journey, knew that time was over, and felt like, I don't know if I can go to heaven. I've reminded them, you look for two things now when the Lord comes. You look for him to bring grace. Gird up the loins of your mind, hope to them for the grace that's to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Tie into that God's grace and God's mercy, and as surely as you have attempted as a baptized believer in Jesus Christ to live for the Lord, your problem is not, am I going to go to heaven? Your problem is, could I miss it? There's no way you're going to miss it. If you are, as a baptized believer in Jesus Christ, depending upon the Lord, bringing mercy when he comes and bringing grace when he comes. Now, we have sung many times, oh, to grace, how great a debtor daily I'm constrained to be. And then when you tie into that the matchless mercy of the Lord that he's going to bring to us one sweet day, then we can live in peace and we can die in hope. And Christian hope is not a fond wish, not even a deep wish. Christian hope, the very concept, anticipation and expectation. And we know for a fact, according to Hebrews chapter 6, that hope anchors our souls. And I promise you, there are some strong tides that are moving across American culture today. It's disturbing, and it's sometimes discouraging to see what is happening to this great land that was founded by men and women who believed in God, who believed the Bible is the Word of God. I do a program, I first did it on the television program. I do a program where I take different pieces of money, like you start with a dollar bill. And I can quote in this program what George Washington actually said about the relationship of our government and our very way of life. And you can trace that thing, and I've traced it way on down, the days of Andrew Jackson. Now, a lot of folks have trouble with Andrew Jackson because of the Trail of Tears. But Andrew Jackson, and I finally found what I was looking for, he said that this book is the rock on which our republic stands. So I've traced it all the way down, from all the way through Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence. And when I found in the background why he would say that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that goes all the way back to a prominent British jurist who said, as a believer in the Bible, he said, "Our rights and our freedoms come from God." Amen. So when I think about looking at the end of the journey and for the grace and the mercy of the Lord, that gives me hope. What do you mean? Anticipation and expectation. And so I'm not going to be carried away with some of these trends, some of these things that are happening in our culture today. It's a sad story, folks. And sometimes when I'm making a presentation with the money showing how it connects to men who believe in the Bible, they want to know if I'm a Republican or a Democrat. I say, I'm a Christocrat. If you want to classify me, I'm a Christocrat. So don't try to pigeonhole me there. If you're a Democrat, that's your business. If you're a Republican, that's your business. And I have no right as a preacher to tell you which side you've got to be on. I'm a Christocrat. I just want to try to find somebody whose values are consistent with the very purpose of our country. Now, when you have this kind of hope, you're anchored. I've traced this thing. It is sad, the number of people in the United States now who claim they don't even believe in God. I did a book not too long ago, and I have a chapter in there on the demise of denominationalism. And I quote prominent denominational leaders who are practically wringing their hands because of the people that have dropped out of their denomination. Well, where do they go? Well, a lot of these people, they go into secularism. They try to find a substitute for the God hole, as Pascal called it. He said, every human being is born with a God hole in the heart. That can only be filled with a right relationship with God. And were it not so sad, it would be downright amusing to see how people are trying to fill that need for God. But going back to Blackstone, he's the jurist, who said, our rights and our freedoms come from God. Now, if enough people in this country decide there is no God, and they're out there now by the millions, folks, at least practical atheism, if enough people in this country decide, why believe in God? There is no God. I'd say, well, look on your money. Look on your coins. Look on your paper money. And I promise you, you will find this statement, in God we trust. Now, would you believe that there is an organization in Washington, D.C., that are trying to get in God we believe or in God we trust? They're trying to get that off of our money. That's secularism, folks. We don't want that on our money. And so they dedicate themselves to trying to get it off of our money. Years ago, going back to Houston, Texas, I was with the University Church in a meeting, and it was only a few blocks from that MD Anderson Cancer Center. Incidentally, that's the only time I ever saw the lady who wanted prayer out of school, Madeline O'Hare Murray. They were in a conference in the motel or the hotel where I was staying, and I think I can remember it was the Gay Rights Conference. And there she was lecturing to those folks. And I started out one night for dinner, and the desk clerk said, hey, preacher, I'm going to show you something. And he reached down and pulled up a stack of Gideon Bibles, and he said, these people have been phoning down here saying, get this out of our room. They're afraid of that book, and well, they might. But I'm going to tell you, folks, in God we trust is on our currency, even on our coins. In God we trust. But when people lose that trust, what do they use to fill the God hole, as Pascal called it, the God hole in the heart? Maybe sports. I love sports. Maybe sports. It may be sex. It may be accumulation of material things. Something we got to have. But only God and a right relation with him will ever fill the God hole, if you please, in our hearts. Now, I've got a question. When should I stop? I see the clock says 5 minutes still. When, Jonathan?
15 after.
15 after. Okay, good. So we come back to this idea. How can I find the right relationship with God Almighty? Well, I brought a book with me today that I want to recommend to help us all find that right relationship with God. And here is the book right here. I'm sure you're familiar with, all of you are familiar with this book, or you wouldn't even be here today. But if you want to find the right relationship with God, take this book and read it and believe it and obey it. Once Jesus said, I have come that they might have life and have it more abundantly. You know, he prefaced that by saying, the thief comes but to steal and destroy and kill. I have come that they might have life and have it more abundantly. It's easy to take things for granted. It's easy to take health for granted until you don't have it. I took it for granted for years. I mean, I was running wide open, as some of you remember, all the time. Last year I held 18 meetings in I don't know how many different states. Man, I was going strong. And then when a virus kicked my heart out of rhythm, I was no longer going strong. And folks, when you don't have the right to drive anymore, you've lost your freedom. At that moment, you become dependent on someone to get you where you need to go. So when I think about the opportunity of being able to have a right relationship with God, and you know, one of the great blessings that comes from a right relationship with God, you have a right relationship with the people of God. One of the richest treasures that I have is association with the people of God. They bless my life. This is the first year I was not able to be on what they call polishing the pulpit. I had been on it from the very first time. There were some preachers in Jacksonville, Alabama, that wanted me to come down and kind of give them a crash course in homiletics. And from that time, I was on the program every year. And it has grown. If any of you were there this year, they had over 4,000 people there for it. And the people that were over there praying for me, I got word they were praying for me. And I've already gotten, I couldn't tell you how many cards from people. I'm going to tell you, the best people on the face of God's earth are God's people. And when you have that relationship with God's people, you are indeed a rich, rich person, because you have something that money cannot buy. If you had all the money in the world, you cannot buy true friendship. It is a gift of God. And true Christian friendship comes with a package deal. It comes with brotherly love. It comes with brotherly concern. It comes with a willingness to help any way that you possibly can. So I think in terms of what Jesus brought. I've come that they might have life and have it more abundantly. In contrast to the devil, who came to steal and destroy, Jesus came to give life. And the great blessing of that life is peace and joy. How much would you quantify the value of peace of mind? How many people are trying to find peace of mind in the bottle or in drugs? You won't find it. You'll find it only in a right relationship with God Almighty. So I've come that they might have real life, a life of peace, and yes, a life of joy. God's people are happy people. Studies have shown that people with a good, positive attitude tend to have healthier hearts and tend to be healthier people. Years ago, I was privileged to write a book, When All Parents and Grandparents Practice Medicine Without a License. And I interviewed a lot of older people about the remedies they used back in what some call the good old days. I mean, before we had access to antibiotics and heart transplants and all of that. And to find people even in that era, and that was the era in which I was born, to find people of that time, if you found people that could laugh and that enjoyed life, that tended to promote their own health. And if you met people that were pessimistic, that couldn't see anything but the dark side of life. Now, none of you are old enough to remember an old song the Carter family used to do on the Grand Ole Opry. It said, there's a bright and sunny side of life. There's a dark and a dreary side too. Keep on the sunny side. That was the chorus. Keep on the sunny side. Now, I'm not going to sit around at home and bemoan the fact I can't drive anymore and I don't have that kind of freedom anymore. I write books. I keep myself busy writing and answering the phone, people calling, trying to help people with certain problems in life. But I'm not about to spend my last days as a pessimist. You know, a real pessimist is a fellow who feels bad when he feels good for fear he'll feel worse when he feels better. And I've often said, I want to be an old man, and my grandkids say, you're already there, fella. I want to be an old man, but I don't want to be a sour old man. I don't want to be a grumbling, griping old man. I want to keep on the sunny side of life. And that's what I try to do. I was in a meeting, I think in Dallas, Texas, and in the hotel where I was staying, after two or three days at breakfast, they get to know your face. So I went down to sign my check one day, and this lady looked at me and said, well, what do you know today? And I looked her straight in the face. I said, I know today. I wouldn't swap the way I feel for the ego boost of a $10,000 funeral if everybody looked at me and said, mine doesn't he look natural. And she was shocked until she said to me, man, you are weird. I said, maybe so, but I love life. Love life. I read in the Bible, he that will love life and see good days, I'm in 1 Peter chapter 3, as you know. He that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lip that they speak no guile. Let him turn away from evil and do good. There we are, the merciful folks now. We're doing good. Seek peace and pursue it, because he says the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous and his ears are open to their prayers. How would you quantify the value of being able to pray? You know, there are different kinds of prayers. I'm in the process of trying to get an article together on what the disciples asked Jesus one time, Lord, teach us to pray. We have to be taught how to really pray. When I pray for people, and it takes me a little while to run the list, I take their name before God's throne in prayer. Now, when you look at the prayer that Jesus taught the disciples to pray, it doesn't take very long to pray it. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, or we say spread today. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses or debts as we forgive those who sin against us. It doesn't take you very long to say that prayer that Jesus taught the disciples to pray. But sometimes people pray and pray and pray and pray. The longest prayer I've ever heard about was prayed at the Freed Hardeman graduation back a few years ago. 30 minutes. That's a little long, I'd say, for a prayer. I was in a meeting down in Adamsville, Alabama, and they wanted to have a day service so the working people could come to the day service and didn't get on to their jobs. And the late Bobby Duncan was explaining it to folks. He said, now, we're going to have a day service in this meeting. We're going to start. We're going to have one song. We're going to have a prayer. And Tom's going to preach. And we're going to get you out in 30 minutes. And then he said, now, if you're not caught up on your praying, we don't want you to lead. But if you're caught up on your praying, then we want you to lead. So prayers do not have to be eternal to be immortal. Someone was telling me about this elderly couple. They arrived late for the worship service, and a deacon was kind of keeping the door and welcomed them in, and they apologized for being late. He said, no, you're not really late. He said, old brother so-and-so called his name, said he's leading prayer today, and he said he just got the children of Israel across the Red Sea, saying we've got 40 years to go through the wilderness. So prayers do not have to be eternal to be immortal. But now I'm going to tell you, it takes me a while with my private prayers. I've got a whole list of people for whom I pray every day, many of whom are battling cancer. Many are trying to get over cancer. They have it in remission and praying that God will keep it in remission. But public prayers, I don't want them to be eternal to be really successful. And I'm not telling you how to pray. You pray the way you pray. That's your business and not mine. Back to this idea. When my Lord comes, I tell you what I'm looking for him to bring for me. I'm looking for him to bring me mercy. That's what we're talking about. Blessed are the merciful. That's what Jude said. Jude 21. Look for the mercy of the Lord for everlasting life. That's what I'm looking for. And then I'm looking for grace. Because 1 Peter 1:9, gird up the loins of your mind and hope to the end for the grace that's to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So as surely as I am doing what I can to serve my Lord, I confess his precious name, I was baptized into Christ, I know what he's going to bring me and what he'll bring you. If you're a baptized believer, he's going to bring you grace and he's going to bring you mercy. And that will be your hope. That is my hope. And so Jesus said, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. I'm going to conclude. I've got 5 minutes, and they say the longest 5 minutes in the world is when the preacher says, now in my last 5 minutes. But I see on the clock, I've got 5 minutes. I want to thank this church again. I told Drew and Anna that I was honored to preach for this congregation many, many years ago. I guess I was probably 26, 27 years old at the time. And this church has done nothing but bless my life. The church exists today in Beloit, Wisconsin, because East Hill supported us to go up there and plant the Lord's church in that town. East Hill is the one that supported it, so I could go and my family and do that. You think I will ever forget that? No. Not as long as I have memory, I will not forget it. But I shall be grateful. And I'm a great believer in the providence of God. And if I had time, I would give you an example. If you doubt the providence of God, the late Brother Gus Nichols once said, "The promises of God are sure, but His providence is perhaps or maybe." I could give you an example of God's providence that I think would convince everybody here. I'll just quickly give it to you. The Germans, just in a lab just north of Berlin, were that close to developing atomic power, which they claimed would be for beneficial services. The French found out about it. And they sent commandos in to destroy that clinic. And in the process, they killed Albert Einstein and his associates. Now, what do you think would be the history of the world if those Germans had been allowed to complete that atomic power? You know the rest of the story. A lot of those German scientists fled to this country. And then we had some people. This country alone was the superpower with the atomic bomb potential. And then we had a man and his wife by the name of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg that sold the atomic secrets to the Russians. And for that, they were tried for being un-American, and they were put to death. And so I've often thought, what if Hitler and the Germans had developed that atomic bomb? Now, I'm talking to you what I believe is God's providence. God did not let that happen through His providence to give those people access to the ability to control the world. This country has a decency about it. There are enough decent people left. Folks are asking me, why doesn't God destroy this country? Look what He did to Sodom. My answer is, but you remember, if they'd found 10 righteous people, God would not have destroyed Sodom. And folks, you and I may be one of the reasons this country still stands. Don't underestimate your importance, not only to the church, but even to the very survival of our country. I thank you so much for the joy and the honor of being here today, and I hope that what we've had to say will be encouraging you to be merciful. Look for the person by the side of the road that's been beaten and show mercy, as Jesus had this fellow to say. Who was the neighbor? The one that showed mercy. It's not hard to see. When people are nice and kind and merciful and helpful, it pays. It'll come back. Because the merciful shall obtain mercy. If not in this life, over on the other side, it'll come back. Oh, you were the merciful one. That's right. Thank you for your good attention.
When peace like a